All right, hopefully you all are seeing that screen. Screen you're sharing is that one. Perfect. Okay. Our exhortation this morning is entitled Worship the Age to Come, Part 3. Okay. This morning we'll be continuing our consideration of the Temple of Ezekiel's prophecy as part of our series on worship in the age to come. Let's see if this thing works. There it goes. Okay. In previous talks on this subject, we've considered the structure and function of the outer four-square complex, including the stream that is passed through when entering the temple, the slaying and the cleaning tables for the sacrifices, the array of cella buildings for lodging and eating, the outer court for travel round about Zion, and the corner towers for cooking and preparing meals. Today we'll begin considering the inner temple building by examining its general layout and function, including the reasoning behind why we believe it to be circular based on the measurements provided in the text. We'll hold off on the remainder of the details of the size, function, and the decorative aspects of this temple building for a future talk. First, a general description of the structure is provided in the latter verses of Ezekiel chapter 40, starting at verse 44, which Brother Henry Sully suggests ought to be considered the beginning of chapter 41, which includes the more detailed measurements of the temple. So let's go ahead and read that. Ezekiel chapter 40, and we're going to read 44 to 49. And without the inner gate were the chambers of the singers and the inner court, which was at the side of the north gate, and their prospect was toward the south, one at the side of the east gate having the prospect toward the north. And he said unto me, the chamber whose prospect is toward the south is for the priests, the keepers of the charge of the house. And the chamber whose prospect is toward the north is for the priests, the keepers of the charge of the altar. These are the sons of Zadok, among the sons of Levi, which come near to Yahweh to minister unto him. So he measured the court 100 cubits long and 100 cubits broad, 4 square, and the altar that was before the house. And he brought me to the porch of the house, and measured each post of the porch 5 cubits on this side and 5 cubits on that side. And the breadth of the gate was 3 cubits on this side and 3 cubits on that side. The length of the porch was 20 cubits, and the breadth, or the height, 11 cubits. Excuse me, that one's actually width. 11 cubits. And he brought me by the steps whereby they went up to it, and there were pillars by the posts on the one side and another on that side. So there'll be a lot more we're going to read, but that should get us started. We're going to really focus in on these first four verses, verses 44 through 46. In these verses, we find a few key details. First, we find that the inner temple is made up of an array of chambers, or cella, just as we saw before with the outer and inner gate buildings. However, these cella buildings are specified as the chambers of the singers. The phrase of the singers is the Hebrew shir shor, which is a primitive root meaning properly to turn, travel about, go sing. This phrase then has the idea of both singing and dancing, and the turning aspect may also be a hint towards the overall shape of the structure, which we'll get back to. The Hebrew shir shor is used elsewhere in Scripture in reference to the singers appointed by David and Solomon for the tabernacle and temple, the singing of the praises to Yahweh throughout the Psalms, and in the songs that commemorate Yahweh's victories over the enemies of Israel. So, for example, the song of Moses and of Miriam, the song of Deborah and Barak, and the singing of the women when David returned from the slaughter of the Philistines. We'll look at that last one, 1 Samuel 18, 6 and 7. For Samuel 18, 6 and 7. And it came to pass as they came when David was returned from the slaughter of the Philistine, that the women came out of all the cities of Israel singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tabrets, with joy, with instruments of music. And the women answered one another as they played, and said, Saul hath slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands. So again, you have this singing and dancing with tabrets, with joy and instruments of music. It's the same idea we have with these chambers of the singers. Let me find my spot here. Surely similar songs of praise and victory will be sung when the greater than David is enthroned in Zion. Quoting from the Temple of Ezekiel's prophecy on page 72, quote, service of song may be one of the methods by which the people will be taught the judgments of the Lord. What can be more impressive than an innumerable company of messengers chanting divine precepts or hymning words of praise? Presumably, the angels sang at the birth of Jesus in anticipation of the glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace and goodwill towards men, a prophecy which yet awaits fulfillment when the rule of David's son is established for all the earth. Continuing with that quote, but peals of praise will ascend from the buildings and the inner court, which then become an everlasting monumental memorial of angelic song, and are therefore called the chambers, cella, of the singers. We're going to read those two verses he has there at the end. First, Psalm 27, 4 to 6. Psalm 27, 4 to 6. One thing have I desired of Yahweh that I will seek after, that I may dwell in the house of Yahweh all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of Yahweh and to inquire in his temple. For in the time of trouble he shall hide me in his pavilion. In the secret of his tabernacle, or his tent, shall he hide me. He shall set me upon a rock. And now shall mine head be lifted up above mine enemies round about me. Therefore will I offer in his tabernacle sacrifices of joy. I will sing, yea, I will sing praises unto Yahweh. We're also going to read Psalm 149. We're going to start at verse 1. Psalm 149, and we're going to read 1 through 6. Praise ye Yahweh, sing unto Yahweh a new song, and his praise in the congregation of the saints. Let Israel rejoice in him that made him. Let the children of Zion be joyful in their king. Let them praise his name in the dance. Let them sing praises unto him with the timbrel and harp. For Yahweh taketh pleasure in his people. He will beautify the meek with salvation. Let the saints be joyful in glory. Let them sing aloud upon their beds. Let the high praises of God be in their mouth and a two-edged sword in their hand. Returning to Ezekiel chapter 40, we see that these chambers of the singers are divided into two distinct groups for the two types of priests that will minister in the future age. First, there is a group of chambers without the inner gate on the north side with our overall prospect or facing towards the south. This is attributed to the immortal Levitical priests in verse 45, who are the keepers of the charge or the function of the house. The second group of chambers are described as without the inner gate on the east side with our overall prospect or facing to the north. So the inner gate on the east side with our overall prospect or facing to the north. This is attributed to the immortal sons of Zadok in verse 46, which come near to Yahweh to minister unto him. So the Levitical priests minister unto the house, and the Zadokian priests minister unto Yahweh. Now, the description of this second group is a bit peculiar. As we continue into the details of the overall structure of the temple in chapter 41 and onwards, and we go through some of the math and geometry used using the measurements that were given, we will find the overall shape of the structure is circular, as presented in Brother Sully's sketch here. And this one just includes both of the highlights on the slide. Thus, attributing the northern half circle of chambers that face southwards towards the altar, to the Levitical priesthood, and the southern half circle of chambers that face north to the altar for the sons of Zadok. So the question then is, why did the Spirit, through Ezekiel, describe the northern group of chambers as being within the northern gate of the inner court, but then describe the southern group of chambers as being within the eastern gate of the inner court. I have a couple thoughts on this, which connects the direction of north with the functions of the Levitical priests in the age to come, and the directions of east and south with the Zadokian priests in the age to come. So on this slide, hopefully it shows up well. I highlighted the northern inner gates, because that's where these chambers are described as being outside of. And then I've highlighted the entire eastern side, which is where the sons of Zadok, where their chambers are described as being outside of. So hopefully that makes sense with the color coding there. All right, so regarding these directions, thinking back to the encampment of Israel in the wilderness, you'll recall that the various families of the priesthood were to camp directly around the tabernacle. Let's go and read Numbers chapter 3. I'll read a couple of verses out of here regarding where those different priestly families were to camp. So Numbers chapter 3, first verse 17. Let's see here. And these were the sons of Levi by their names, Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. So those are the three families we're going to look at. Verses 23 to 26. The families of the Gershonites shall pitch behind the tabernacle westward. And the chief of the house of the father of the Gershonites shall be Eliasaph, the son of Lael. And the charge of the sons of Gershon and the tabernacle of the congregation shall be the tabernacle, the tent, the covering thereof, and a hanging for the door of the tabernacle of the congregation, and the hangings of the court, and the curtain for the door of the court, which is by the tabernacle, and by the altar round about, and the cords of it for all the service thereof. And then skipping to verse 29 to 31. The families of the sons of Kohath shall pitch on the side of the tabernacle southward, and the chief of the house of the father of the families of Kohathites shall be Elizaphan, the son of Uziel, and their charge shall be the ark, and the table, and the lampstand, and the altars, and the vessels of the sanctuary wherewith they minister, and the hanging, and all the service thereof. And skipping down to verse 35 to 38. And the chief of the house of the father of the families of Merari was Zuriel, the son of Abihail. These shall pitch on the side of the tabernacle northward. And under the custody and charge of the sons of Merari shall be the boards of the tabernacle, and the bars thereof, and the pillars thereof, and the sockets thereof, and all the vessels thereof, and all that serveth thereto, and the pillars of the court round about, and their sockets, and their pins, and their cords. So all that's left now, what about the east side? Verse 38, but those that encamp before the tabernacle toward the east, even before the tabernacle of the congregation eastward, shall be Moses and Aaron and his sons, keeping the charge of the sanctuary, for the charge of the children of Israel, and the stranger that cometh nigh shall be put to death. So we'll first consider this eastern side. On the eastern side, as we read, it was set aside for Moses and Aaron and his sons, who had the charge of the sanctuary. Moses and Aaron being the only ones that could enter into the Most Holy, Moses for a time, and then Aaron as high priest, and later on his sons as high priests. Here we see the offices of both king and priest represented on the eastern side with Moses. On the eastern side, period. With Moses, in this case, representing the office of king. Deuteronomy 33, 4 and 5 states, Moses commanded us a law, even the inheritance of the congregation of Jacob. And he, Moses, was king, that word there is Melech. He, Moses, was king in Jeshurun, which is another name for Israel, when the heads of the people and the tribes of Israel were gathered together. So again, Moses represents, in this case, he wasn't king, but he was in this representative manner, a king. Thus it follows that in Ezekiel, we see the chambers set aside for the sons of Zadok, who minister unto Yahweh in the Most Holy, are described as being within the inner gate on the east, the eastern inner gate. So that's why I think that the east is mentioned there. There is an association, then, of the sons of Zadok with the east. Revelation 16:12 states, and the sixth angel poured out his vial into the great river Euphrates, and the water thereof was dried up, that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared. Those kings of the east, or the kings of the sun's rising, as it's sometimes rendered, are those who will make up this future Zadokian priesthood. Further, You recall the entire Eastern Gate complex is set aside for the Prince, Jesus, the Melchizedekian King Priest. Let's read Ezekiel 44, 1 to 3. Ezekiel 44, 1 to 3. Then he brought me back by the way of the gate outward of the outward sanctuary which looketh toward the east, and it was shut. Then Yahweh said unto me, This gate shall be shut, it shall not be opened, and no man shall enter in by it, because Yahweh, the God of Israel, hath entered in by it, therefore it shall be shut. So we'll read it later on about the glory of Yahweh coming in on the eastern side. It is for the prince. The prince, he shall sit in it to eat bread before Yahweh. He shall enter by the way of the porch of that gate, and shall go out by the way of the same. So again, that eastern side is the portion for the prince. So again, it's associated both with Jesus, the Melchizedekian king priest, and the sons of Zadok, the immortalized saints. Now let's consider the north side. The north side of the priestly encampment in the wilderness had the sons of Merari. In Numbers 3, we read that the sons of Merari, or the Merarites, camped on the north and had the charge of the boards, bars, pillars, sockets, and all the vessels of the tabernacle. These comprised a good portion of the implements of the overall structure and functions of the tabernacle service, and seemed to match up well with what we read in Ezekiel 40, where the Levitical priests are noted as the keepers of the charge of the house. So we'll set that aside for a moment, just thinking about it. So again, they had all the structural aspects of the tabernacle and most of the vessels. They didn't have all the vessels. We'll get to those in a minute. But they had the general function of the house was under the auspices or the charge of the Merarites. But what about the functions of the Kohathites and the Gershonites? Where do they fit in to this picture in the future age? We noted earlier that the chambers for the sons of Zadok, while associated with the east gate, form a half circle on the southern side of the altar with its prospect toward the north. We might expect then that the functions of the sons of Zadok in the future age would also bear some similarity to that of the Kohathites, who were to camp on the southern side of the tabernacle. What were the Kohathites charged with? Come up. Okay, good. Numbers 3:31 again states, "And their charge, the Kohathites, shall be the ark, and the table, and the lampstand, and the altars, and the vessels of the sanctuary, wherewith they minister, and the hanging, and all the service thereof." These are the implements of the actual tabernacle itself, and both the holy, and more importantly here, the most holy, which in the future age, of course, the sons of Zadok are the only ones who will be able to enter into that most holy place. Here again, we see a connection. Ezekiel 44, 15, and 16 states, "But the priests, the Levites, the sons of Zadok, that kept the charge of my sanctuary when the children of Israel went astray from me, they shall come near to me to minister unto me, and they shall stand before me to offer unto me the fat and the blood." So remember, the Kohathites had the altars. Saith Adonai Yahweh, "They shall enter into my sanctuary, they shall come near to my table." And the table was under the auspices or the charge of the Kohathites. "To minister unto me, they shall keep my charge." That is the charge of Yahweh. That leads us to consider the function of the Gershonites, who camped on the western side of the tabernacle. You'll note that the western side is not mentioned in Ezekiel's description of a temple structure. So let's look again at the Gershonites, or what the Gershonites were charged with, to figure out why. Numbers 3:25 says, "And the charge of the sons of Gershon in the tabernacle of the congregation shall be of the tabernacle and the tent, and the covering thereof, and the hanging for the door of the tabernacle of the congregation, and the hangings of the court, and of the curtain, and the curtain for the door of the court, which is by the tabernacle, and by the altar round about, and the cords of it for all the services thereof." The charge of the Gershonites was related to the hangings and the coverings of the tabernacle. I would submit that this function is no longer applicable to the priesthood in the future age. Rather, Yahweh will provide the covering for the temple as a cloud to shield the presence of his glory. Regarding his glory, let's read Ezekiel 43, 1 to 5. Turn over to Ezekiel 43, 1 to 5. Afterward, he brought me to the gate, even the gate that looketh toward the east. So we mentioned this earlier. Behold, the glory of God, the God of Israel, came from the way of the east, and his voice was like the voice of many waters, and the earth shined with his glory. And it was according to the appearance of the vision which I saw, even according to the vision that I saw when I came to destroy the city. And the visions were like the vision that I saw by the river Kibar, and I fell upon my face. And the glory of Yahweh came into the house by the way of the gate, whose prospect is toward the east. So the, let's see how far I want to go there. I think that's all I want to read. One more. So the Spirit took me up and brought me into the inner court, and behold, the glory of Yahweh filled the house. So again, this glory comes in by the east, and it fills the house. You'll recall that this happened to both the tabernacle in the wilderness in Exodus chapter 40, when Moses could not even stand within the tabernacle, and Solomon's temple in 1 Kings chapter 8 during the coronation. They had to wait until the cloud had receded to go back in. Regarding the covering, so again, that was the glory of Yahweh entering, but regarding the covering, let's read Isaiah chapter 4, 3 to 6. Isaiah 4, verse 3, and it shall come to pass that he that is left in Zion, and he that remaineth in Jerusalem, shall be called holy, and every one that is written among the living in Jerusalem, even every one. When the Lord shall have washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion, and shall have purged the blood of Jerusalem from the midst thereof by the spirit of judgment and by the spirit of burning, and Yahweh will create upon every dwelling place of Mount Zion and upon her assemblies a cloud and a smoke by day, and the shining of a flaming fire by night. For upon all the glory shall be a defense, and there shall be a tabernacle or tent for a shadow in the daytime from the heat, and for a place of refuge, and for a covert from storm and from rain. The word defense in verse 5, again, for upon all the glory of Yahweh that entered into the temple we read of, upon all the glory shall be a defense. The word defense in verse 5 is the Hebrew chuppah, meaning a canopy. It comes from a root word, chuppah, meaning to cover, by implication, a veil. Quoting from one of Brother Scott Cram's articles on the subject, quote, "This glory is not to be fully exposed to view. It is to be covered or surrounded by a means of shielding. There is a veiling of this great manifestation of glory from those without. And that is what is portrayed in Brother Sully's sketch on the cover of his book." And here on the slide, that sketch is on the left. In his sanctuary perspective, that's that sketch, possibly overlooked is the cloud with its brilliance. Often mistaken as rays of sunshine, it is actually an attempt to capture the tent and its radiance, a cloud and a smoke by day and the shining of a flaming fire by night, unquote. So again, that cloud, and you can kind of see it down here on the right, really will cover over the most holy place. And the reason the sketch here has the cloud so high up in the air is so that way you can see the layout of the temple and the altar and so forth. Much of that will, of course, be covered over or veiled, as this word indicates. So to summarize those points again overall, bring it back to this slide. In the future age, the mortal Levitical priests assume the responsibilities previously associated with the Merarites who camped in the north. They will be keepers of the charge of the house. The immortal Zadokian priests assume the responsibilities previously associated with Moses and Aaron on the east. Of course, Jesus will be there as well as the high priest. And the Kohathites on the south. They are the keepers of the charge of Yahweh. Meanwhile, Yahweh himself provides the veiling cloud covering the most holy. So while my focus here, and that's the end of my thoughts on that one, while my focus here was on the priestly camps, you could also maybe even expand this and look at the overall encampment as well. These were some unfinished thoughts of mine. If you look at Dan on the north, which would be associated with Levitical priesthood, Dan, of course, is associated with judgment. If you look at Ezekiel 44 and the description of what the Levitical priesthood will do in the future, they are to go out and to judge and discern between the holy and the profane and judge amongst those of the mortal population. So that could certainly be something to look at. Of course, you have the lion of the tribe of Judah, and you have the man of Reuben, down in the south, that will be associated with the Zadokian priesthood. We'll look at later. The cherubim that will be around that temple building have the face of a man and the face of a lion on them. So it could be something there to look at. The one that I was didn't have a fully formed thought on here was then, well, what do you do with the Ephraim side of the ox? A couple of my thoughts on that were, you know, the those who are still bounded by or burdened rather by the flesh and who participate in the service of the temple, you think of the mortals, they will actually travel in, and all of them will travel either north or south on the western side, not the temple itself, but out on the outer court. So that could be the connection there. So if you have any thoughts on that afterwards, let me know. but again, I thought it fit very well, though, when you looked at the actual priestly encampments and the reasoning as to why they're set up the way they are. Okay. Moving on, we've made a mention a few times now of the circular aspect of the temple structure. We'd like to spend our remaining time this morning examining how we arrive at that conclusion. And I'll preface this by noting that we won't be going through every measure of detail of the temple this morning. There's just far much to look at. We'll do more of that in the future, but we will reference some of those measures for the purposes of this exercise this morning. So, before we get to the measures, there are a handful of inferences in the text in Ezekiel that would lead us to contemplate the temple structure as a circle instead of a square like the outer courts. For instance, there is no mention of any corner of the court in the details of the temple structure like we saw with the outer court. Remember, Ezekiel was brought to each of the four corners of the outer court. There is no corners mentioned when it comes to the temple structure itself. We also already noted the element of turning when we looked at the Hebrew word shir shor for the chambers of the singers, those chambers being synonymous again with the temple buildings itself. However, let's also look at Ezekiel 41, verse 1. Ezekiel chapter 41, verse 1. And remember, Ezekiel 41 is really the beginning of all the main details of this inner temple structure. There's a few general details we read at the very beginning, in Ezekiel chapter 40 at the very end, but really the details start coming in chapter 41. So verse 1 here, afterward, he brought me to the temple and measured the post 6 cubits broad on the one side and 6 cubits broad on the other side, which was the breadth of the tabernacle. The breadth of the tabernacle. Here we have the peculiar insertion of the word tabernacle in the description of the temple. The Hebrew word here is ohel, O-H-E-L, meaning tent, and comes from a root word ahal, A-H-A-L, meaning to shine. We would, of course, associate this with the glory of Yahweh and the covering cloud over the Most Holy that we discussed earlier, so that certainly fits in very well. But interestingly, Brother Sully points out that this also lends to the idea of a circular temple. So here we're going to quote again from the Temple of Ezekiel's prophecy, this time on page 40. Quote, the limits of the inner temple are given in chapter 41, verse 1. Omitting the interpolated words of the authorized version, the verse reads, he measured the posts, 6 cubits broad on the one side and 6 cubits broad on the other side, the breadth of the tabernacle. So if we actually remove the parts in between the comma there, it would just be, he measured the post, the breadth of the tabernacle, or for all around the tabernacle. Continuing with the quote, the word translated tabernacle is ohel, and the revised version gives tent in this passage, and in every place, some 330 times where the word occurs, with two exceptions. The word is derived from a verb meaning round or ring-shaped. So we looked at the root word, the direct root of the word earlier, which is where we got that shining from, but it's actually associated with this verb, which means round or ring-shaped, which I thought was very interesting. Thus, a circular ring of buildings forming the inner temple surrounding the hill in the center of the inner court may be said to mark or bound the breadth of the tent. That is, the post of a structure encircling a hill form the limit or boundary of that part of the house called the tent. The temple is one thing, that's the building, and the tent is another, which we discussed earlier. The base of the tent would be the space circumscribed by a circle formed by the innermost posts of the temple building. Unquote. Hopefully that made sense. I thought it was much easier to put the quote up there than try to retranslate it. Brother Sully also emphasizes the conical structure of a hill or a mountain, so a cone. A high point at the center, and in this case with the altar at the top, and then a generally circular base. So typically you look at a mountain, high point, and it goes down in a somewhat circular manner. He references Ezekiel 43:12, which follows the filling of the house with the glory of Yahweh that we referenced earlier. So I have that at the top of the slide here. That verse reads, "This is the law of the house. Upon the top of the mountain, the whole limit thereof, round about, shall be most holy. Behold, this is the law of the house." Now, aside from these fairly convincing inferences, there are two mathematical and geometric proofs presented by Brother Sully in his book, one of which we'll consider this morning, one that I consider the easier one to explain. In the first proof, which we'll look at, we'll compare a calculated circumference with a measured circumference. If the temple, the inner temple building, is indeed a circular building, those two measurements should match up with no remainder. If you remember your geometry lessons, the circumference of a circle is a measure of the perimeter of the circle, and you have two options at arriving at that measurement, both of which we'll go through in the case of Ezekiel's temple. The first is to take a measuring line and go around the perimeter of the circle until that measuring line intersects itself. And then you just simply read that measurement. Or if you had a rope going around a tree, tie the rope all the way around, you'd mark where the rope intersects, and you could just measure the length of that rope. In that case, you're essentially measuring the arc length of a circle as if it were a line segment. The other option is to calculate the circumference by multiplying the diameter of the circle by the mathematical constant pi. The diameter of a circle is a measure of a straight line from one point on a circle through the center to the other side. Meanwhile, pi is a mathematical constant that is equal to the ratio of a circle's circumference to its diameter. Meaning, if you divide the circumference of any circle by its own diameter, you will always end up with a result pi, which is 3.14159. It's a decimal that continues on forever, but they usually truncate it at that point. So 3.14159, that's equal to pi. It's a constant. Knowing this, if you multiply the diameter of a circle, so if you know the diameter, if you multiply that by pi, it will result in the circumference of that circle. And hopefully that'll make sense as we go along. So you've got on the screen here on the right, circumference there is C, the diameter is D, and then you've got this symbol for pi. So again, if you multiply the diameter by pi, you will always get the circumference. If you take the circumference and divide it by the diameter, you'll always get pi. If you take the circumference and divide by pi, you'll get the diameter. You can move them around wherever you want. That works out pretty well. Okay. Let's see. Now, before starting the calculations for this inner temple, we do need to look at a few of the measurements that we haven't looked at yet that are provided for both the separate place between the inner gate of the outer court and the inner temple, and the measure of the depth of the temple building itself. So we'll look at these both first. The open space between the inner gates and the temple structure is called the separate place. So you can see that in the picture on the left. That space is highlighted there in yellow, the separate place. It's called the separate place in Ezekiel 41:13 and is noted as 100 cubits in length at its closest point on every side. So while the distance and the areas between the circular temple and the corners of the court buildings will be much longer, you can see how much a much larger area there. As you can see on the left, the closest point between the temple and the inner court buildings, as seen on the right, so here, is 100 cubits. So that's where that 100 cubits falls in. So knowing that, when we get to the temple itself, it should be noted first that there are porches on the outer and the inner perimeter of the structure. So on the screen here, it looks a little bit blurry, but that's okay. You have the a 20 cubit, which we'll get here in a minute, porch. And then there's the actual temple building itself. And then we'll talk about this line in a minute. And then there's another porch on the inside. Ezekiel 40 verse 49 tells us that the length or the depth of these porches is 20 cubits. So then all that is left to measure then before we get to the perimeter that Brother Sully uses, that's that yellow there, is the depth of the actual temple building. While we are given detailed measurements of each section of the temple structure that can be added up, so you could add up all the different lengths and widths throughout this entire point here, the length of the wall of the building, So we can add all that up, some of which we intend to go through next time. Happily, the remaining length of the temple is also given directly, which is the length of the wall of the building in Ezekiel 41, verse 12, which is 90 cubits in length.
So that's this dark black part right here. It's called the wall of the building.
Brother Sully calls this, or refers to this as the wall for the ribs, which are on either side of each of the temple buildings, and provides the structure for both the vaults of the temple,
so the area here in the center, he calls them vaults,
as well as for the covered openings between the buildings.
So again, you have a wall here, there's an opening we'll talk about in a minute, and then there's another wall on the other side. So each one of these are 90 cubits in length, and they kind of provide an end structure for all the vaults that go across and the coverings.
We'll get to that at a later time. The important point right now is that it's 90 cubits in length. All right, now that given that Ezekiel provides detailed measurements of the width of the porches and their associated posts and the width of the covered openings between each of the buildings, Brother Sully chooses the outer limit of the innermost porch, seen as yellow on the slide, as his boundary. That's where the circle is going to be drawn. He calls that his baseline for his calculations. This will serve as the perimeter of the circle that we'll be calculating this morning. To do the calculation, though, we first need to calculate the diameter of that circle. And to do that, we can take the full width of the sanctuary, which we already know, and we can subtract out everything except for that inner circle. So this will all be tabulated here. Oh, looks like PowerPoint moved my lines, but hopefully it makes sense. That's what happens when you have two different programs. It still follows from top to bottom. All right. You'll recall that the outer gate, the outer court, and the inner gate structures add up to 180 cubits in length. Remember, each of the court buildings were 40 cubits in length, and then the outer court itself was 100, so 180. Additionally, you found that the separate place between the inner gate and the outer porch of the temple is measured at 100 cubits. The outer porch of the temple was measured at 20 cubits, and the depth of the wall of the building of each temple is 90 cubits. In total, measuring from the outside of the outer gates, the outer limit of the innermost porch is 390 cubits. This number needs to be doubled because we're measuring from both sides. So that results in 780 cubits. Again, we already established the full width of the sanctuary complex. That's 500 reeds, if you can read it up there at the top, equal to 3,000 cubits. Thus, we subtract out the 780 cubits from the overall 3,000, and we are left with 2,220 cubits as the diameter of the circle that we're measuring. If we multiply that diameter by the constant pi, it yields a calculated circumference of 6,974 cubits, which you can see there at the bottom of the slide. I'm sorry that my lines and my tabulation there got moved around, but hopefully it's still intelligible. All right, now let's see, we have the circumference calculated. So now let's see if the measurements of the porches and the spaces between each temple building fit with this calculated circumference. Yeah, those lines got moved too. That's okay. I should have checked that earlier. Okay, so first let's consider the covered openings between each of the temple buildings. We learn from verse 6 of Ezekiel 41 that the temple is divided into 30 sections or orders. So there's 30 openings and there's 30 buildings. And from verse 10, that between the cella, that is between each temple building, right here, is a wideness of 20 cubits round about the house on every side. You might be able to actually make it out there. He has it written there, 20 cubits. Verse 12 notes that the thickness of each of the walls of the building is 5 cubits, which means it's 2.5 cubits to the center point of each of those walls. We'll add the 2.5 cubits to the center point on either side of the openings to the 20 cubit width of each opening for a total of 25 cubits per opening. So you can see that on the slide in red. Hopefully you can see that anyway. You can see these lines here at the center point of a post, the center point of a post, which is the same as the center point of the wall. So that's 20 cubits in between, 2.5 here, 2.5 there, 25 in total. 25 cubits multiplied by the 30 openings noted in verse 6 yields a total of 750 cubits attributed to all these openings together. If we subtract that out of our total calculated 6,974 cubits, we're left with 6,224 cubits to work with. If the structure is indeed a circle, then the measure of the width of the porches, which we'll look at here in a second, which takes up the remainder of the perimeter of the circle, should divide evenly into that 6,224 cubits. Ezekiel 40, verse 48 and 49, tells us that the porch entrances are made up. Ezekiel 40, 48, and 49 tells us that the porch entrances are made up of posts that are 5 cubits wide and gates that are 3 cubits wide. We also learn in chapter 18 and 19, that these posts alternate between pillars decorated as palm trees and cherubim statues with a lion and man's head on them. We'll talk more about those next time. You can see that at the bottom. Down here at the bottom, you'll see there's a cherubim, and then there's a post with a palm tree pillar. And the cherubim, palm tree pillar. Cherubim, so it goes back and forth. Let's see here. To get the measure of each porch opening, we need to take into account the 2 3-cubit wide gates and a full 5-cubit post. In this case, it would have a cherubim on top of it. This totals 11 cubits, matching up with what we're told in Ezekiel 40, verse 49, which has the measure at 40 cubits. And you can see that at the top of the image here. So we have this would have the cherubim on it. This is 5 cubits wide, just as these are 5 cubits wide. And each gate is 3 cubits wide, which makes this section right here 11 cubits. I'll catch up with my notes here. However, to account for the post with the palm tree pillars, we also need to include 2.5 cubits on either side of the 11-cubit porch openings, or 5 additional cubits. This totals 16 cubits in width, which you can see here at the bottom of the image. So I have it down here just to try to make it not quite as messy up top. So again, you have the 11 cubits, and you've got 2.5 cubits on either side for these palm tree pillar sections. That way you have a continuous section by section by section as you go all the way around. So we take the remaining 6,224 cubit from our calculated perimeter, from our calculation, and divide that by the 16 cubit width of each porch section, as I'm calling it. It yields 389 porch sections without any remainder. So the math works out in that case. Or to tabulate this from the other direction, sometimes this makes a little bit more sense. Think about it the other way. The distance between the center point of the palm tree pillars of each porch section is 16 cubits. Multiply this by 389 sections, and the result is 6,224. The distance from the center points of each wall of the building is 25 cubits. Multiply this by 30 openings, and the result is 750. We add these two together, we get a total measured circumference of 6,974 cubits, which exactly aligns with our calculated circumference. So hopefully one of those two directions helped to line it up for you all. Now, if you're interested in the second proof, which we're not going to go through this morning, which involves the use of a geometric ratio calculation based on the radii from the center of the circle to the inner and outer doorways of the temple, I'll refer you to both the Temple of Ezekiel's Prophecy by Brother Sully, starting on page 48, as well as Brother Scott Cram's article on the topic in Volume 7, Issue 4 of The Truth Gleaner on page 27. If you weren't already convinced already, it further solidifies the point, but I found it a bit too complicated for me to try to translate it and present it in this exhortation. But what it does is it actually takes the measure of the door you can see right here, this doorway being 6 cubits, and there's a verse that says the widening of the door as 7. So if this one's 6, then you go out to the outside of the temple, and the other one's 7, you do some math and ratios, and it basically just shows again that the circle fits in that way as well. So on your own time, I'll let you investigate that. Okay. Now, a great deal of effort was expended in order to show the circular design of the inner temple building. But ultimately, why is that important? Certainly, as we've noted in previous talks on the subject, we could simply state that Ezekiel was commanded to behold with thine eyes and hear with thine ears and set thine heart upon all that I shall show thee. To the intent that I might show them unto thee art thou brought hither. Declare all that thou seest to the house of Israel. So we could just rely on that. It was put into the scriptures for us to read and understand, therefore it's important, which agreed. However, I would suggest that the importance also lies in the fact that the shape of the circle is associated with the everlasting covenant and with Israel. So we see this in the encampment of Israel, and also when the, as we saw earlier on the slide, and also when they left, when they would move, they would actually go in a circular fashion. You see this in the wheels of the cherubim earlier in Ezekiel, the first couple chapters. You think of it as Judah being the apple of Yahweh's eye. You think of the eye as a circle within a circle. And we'd like to conclude this morning by considering briefly the rainbow as the sign of the everlasting covenant. And just by happenstance, we went through this in Wednesday class. We're not going to go into that level of detail, so thankfully it should be fresh in your mind. But overall, I'm supposed to go to the next slide here. There we go. Consider first that the circle has no end and no beginning, just as Yahweh is from everlasting to everlasting. Secondly, we see in the circular nature of the rainbow that the only way to enter to the center of the rainbow is to travel through its sevenfold progression of colors from the outside to the inside, which, as has been noted in previous studies on the subject, shows the step-by-step process of salvation for the righteous. That progression is summarized as follows. We'll start from the outside. Those who partake of the water of the word and are obedient unto the light of the Son of Righteousness. So it takes light and that refraction in the water to create the color in the first place. Those who are obedient unto those and enter into the covenant through the waters of baptism choose to come out of sin and are atoned for by the blood of Christ. There you have red, both sin and sacrifice. Through fiery trial, the orange, they will come forth as gold, that's the yellow, and will appear at the resurrection and judgment to receive life eternal, the green. Being healed from the fleshly state of man to become perfect manifestations of Yahweh, that's the blue, which is both healing and godliness, and progress from a royal priesthood to being kings and priests on the earth, the kings and priests, that indigo and violet. When all these factors are considered together as a whole, you end up with a picture of the redeemed saints in future manifestation, and certainly when you look at the temple itself as a symbol of that. Here we have the bride of Christ in white apparel. You will remember that all these colors of the visible spectrum together make up white light. You only see these colors when they've been refracted either by the atmosphere or through a prism or water or what have you into its various wavelengths. Altogether, it's white light. We see the same format of approach presented in the tabernacle in the wilderness, which we looked at earlier, and in the Temple of Solomon, and in the Temple of Ezekiel's prophecy that we've considered this morning. In each case, the covenanted must proceed from the outside inwards in a specific prescribed manner in their approach unto Yahweh in the center. And literally, in the kingdom age, the glory of Yahweh will reside in that center, as we spoke of. In the age to come, the sons of Zadok, that indigo and violet kings and priests, will stand in the chambers of the singers and will sing a new song before the throne, a song which will be sung during the coronation of the temple following the subduing of the nations. So we'd like to close by reading of this song in Revelation chapter 15, verses 2 to 4. So in considering all the songs that might be sung, this one's probably first and foremost in our minds, Revelation 15, 2 to 4. Specifically sung by the sons of Zadok. And I saw, as it were, a sea of glass having been mingled with fire. So this is the nations, the sea of nations have been subdued. They are as a sea of glass. They've gone through that fiery judgment. And them that had gotten the victory over the beast and over his image and over his mark and over the number of his name stand on the sea of glass, having the harps of God. And they sing the song of Moses, the servant of God, and the song of the Lamb, saying, great and marvelous are thy works, Lord God Almighty. Just and true are thy ways, thou King of saints. Who shall not fear thee, O Lord, and glorify thy name? For thou only art holy. For all nations shall come and worship before thee, for thy judgments are made manifest. So that's why I believe this will occur at the coronation of this temple, because that will be true for all those, once this temple is built, that these nations will come and worship before the glory of Yahweh. And that ends our exhortation for this morning. More on that next time.